Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
It's the Brian Lehrer Show on WNYC. Good morning again, everyone. With me now is Washington Post columnist and deputy editorial page editor Ruth Marcus. She has described the Trump impeachment process as Kavanaugh 2.0, and she's in a good position to make that comparison. Ruth has a new book called Supreme Ambition, Brett Kavanaugh and the Conservative Takeover. So we'll talk about the comparison between that and impeachment. We'll talk about Nancy Pelosi's announcement this morning. Maybe we'll follow up on our last segment about Kamala Harris getting out of the race. And a spoiler alert with respect to the book. On page 364, Ruth writes that Christine Blasey Ford's father and Brett Kavanaugh's father are golf buddies, and Ralph Blasey emailed Ed Kavanaugh the day after the final vote to say he was glad Brett had been confirmed. Ruth, great to have you back. Thanks for coming on today.
Thank you so much for having me.
Wait, what? Did Ralph Blasey really say that to Ed Kavanaugh?
He really did. And there had been a discussion throughout the confirmation hearings after Christine Blasey Ford's allegations became public about where her family was. And the truth is that one of the reasons she had been so reluctant to come public and to expose was that she was worried about exposing her family, not just her family back home in California where she lives, but her parents and her brothers who still live here in the Washington area. She's got nieces and nephews as well. She did not want to expose them to public scrutiny because she knew they lived in a very small, insular, almost tribal community. And behind the scenes, I have to say, her parents were supportive of her testimony. They came, I described this in the book, coming to visit her at the Watergate Hotel where she was holed up with her team in the aftermath of that testimony. Her father told her that he was proud of her, but there is this just ineluctable fact of the email that he sent to Ed Kavanaugh, Justice Kavanaugh's father, the morning after the confirmation, saying that he was glad that Brett Kavanaugh, whom his daughter had accused of trying to sexually assault her, had been confirmed. And that is just a painful fact that I unearthed and needed to report in this book.
Are you the person who revealed that email to Dr. Ford, or did she already know?
I am not clear on the state of knowledge. I had been asking about it. I've been hearing about it for months and asking about it for months. But I do know that I would not have. This is such a painful moment that if I was not 100% certain that it was true, I would not have included it in the book. I would not have included anything in the book that I wasn't 100% certain was true. Mm-hmm. But I knew this one was so powerful. I wanted to be especially careful about it.
How much of a price do you think Dr. Ford has been paying to this day?
I think that's a really important question, and the answer is quite a bit. This is not a person who ever sought the limelight. In my hours of conversation with her, she talked about how it was even difficult for her to get up in front of her class of students at the beginning of the term in California when she was teaching them statistics because she does not like performing in public. And she did have, she talked about this quite passionately, this combined sense of civic duty that she felt like she had information that senators should hear, and an incredible naivete, I would say, particularly for somebody who grew up in the confines of Washington, D.C., about how she thought she would be able to bring this information to the attention of the White House, to the attention of the senators, and have it handled in a private way. It exploded. She became a recognizable public figure. It was not for 3 months that she was able to move back into her own home, and she's had to engage in intensive security measures. And so there's been both a physical toll on her and her family, and probably even greater an emotional toll.
You argue in the book that the Democrats were ineffective and unwilling to engage in the kinds of no-holds-barred partisan warfare that the Republicans engage in. What else could they have done in the Kavanaugh fight, in your opinion?
Well, I write in the book that the Democrats had a bad hand and they proceeded to play it badly. The bad hand was one they had some role in dealing themselves, which was prior to the Kavanaugh nomination, every nominee previously had faced the requirement, at least in theory, of having to obtain 60 votes because there was the possibility that the nominee could be filibustered. In the Gorsuch nomination, in the angry aftermath of the Republicans having effectively stolen the seat that Merrick Garland was nominated for, the Scalia seat, Democrats played their hand and decided that the filibuster for Supreme Court nominees that had already been eliminated for lower court nominees, it was going to be removed no matter what. And so they were going to force Republicans to go nuclear and remove the filibuster in the Gorsuch nomination. I think that was a mistake because, though many people disagree, imagine a world in which the filibuster had remained for, they had not filibustered Gorsuch, they allowed him to be confirmed. The filibuster was then in place when Justice Kavanaugh was nominated and the Christine Blasey Ford allegations were roiling the country. In that context, would Susan Collins, Senator from Maine, would Lisa Murkowski, would other institutionalist Republicans in the Senate have been willing to undo the filibuster? Institutional Republicans being willing to undo the filibuster? I think not. So bad playing field. And then the really inescapable fact of the matter is that and I write about this extensively in the book, and I try to do it with some care and sensitivity. The lead Democrat in charge of the hearings was Dianne Feinstein, the oldest member of the Senate. She lived in a sort of older bipartisan kind of bygone world of the Senate. And honestly, she was not the fierce advocate that she once was. And I think she was not the right captain for an all-out fight. And I think the way she handled the Christine Blasey Ford allegations, which were very difficult to handle because Christine Ford reasonably asked for a confidentiality, but Dianne Feinstein sat on those allegations, didn't even let the senior members of her leadership know the decision that she was making. I think that also did not help this bad hand that the Senate Democrats started with.
You mentioned Susan Collins. Let me play a clip of her from just after the confirmation, or just as she was announcing that she was going to vote for the confirmation of Brett Kavanaugh, in which she pretty much predicted that based on her contact with him, that he would uphold Roe versus Wade if he winds up voting on it. Listen.
In his testimony, he noted repeatedly that Roe had been upheld by Planned Parenthood versus Casey, describing it as precedent on precedent. When I asked him, would it be sufficient to overturn a long-established precedent if five current justices believed that it was wrongly decided, he emphatically said no.
So, Ruth Marcus, what do you think about that? Do you think that Brett Kavanaugh kind of promised the world, or Susan Collins via the hearings, or however you might want to put it, that he's going to vote to uphold Roe?
Well, it depends on what the meaning of uphold Roe is. I think Brett Kavanaugh recited to Susan Collins all of the reasons, important reasons, that he, like other justices, would be reluctant to overturn precedent. But we will see. My prediction is that certainly with five votes on the court, a five-justice conservative majority, the court would be very reluctant to outright overrule Roe. But I think that that's not really the most important question. The question is, what are these five conservative justices? And they could be joined by a sixth, and if they're joined by a sixth, they're joined by a seventh. I think Roe itself could fall. But even before that, in fact, this very term, we are going to have an abortion case at the Supreme Court, a case that involves an abortion restriction that is almost identical to an abortion restriction that the court with Justice Kennedy, who Justice Kavanaugh replaced, provided the fifth vote for to strike down the restriction. Now, an identical one is back at the Supreme Court again. I think it will be very interesting and very telling to see whether Justice Kavanaugh votes the same way that Justice Kennedy did to strike down that law, or whether, as I think is more likely, he'll vote to uphold it. And then I think it will be really interesting to hear from Susan Collins about how she feels about her vote.
My guest is Washington Post columnist and deputy editorial page editor Ruth Marcus. Her new book is Supreme Ambition, Brett Kavanaugh and the Conservative Takeover. In a minute, we'll see why she calls impeachment Kavanaugh 2.0. We also have some breaking impeachment news to bring you right after this break. Stay with us. Brian Lehrer on WNYC. Brian Lehrer on WNYC as we continue with Washington Post columnist and deputy editorial page editor Ruth Marcus. Her new book is Supreme Ambition, Brett Kavanaugh and the Conservative Takeover. We can take some phone calls for her at 212-433-WNYC, 212-433-9692. Ruth, the New York Times review of your book says the most interesting part is your discussion of why, in the end, the evidence mattered so little. Do you think evidence mattered little?
I do. I think that we are at this moment in our politics where votes can be almost perfectly predicted based on political party. Votes on judges, votes now on impeachment or conviction of President Trump in the proceedings that we're watching. And that is, we tend to forget, it hasn't always been like that. If you look back to the Bork nomination, which was the opening salvo in the 30 years of judicial nominations wars that I talk about in Supreme Ambition, a number of Republicans, six Republicans, voted against then-Judge Bork, not to confirm him. Two Democrats switched party lines and voted to confirm him. It wasn't this automatic just resort to this is what my side believes. And I think we see both in the Kavanaugh confirmation and in the impeachment hearings that we're going through now, not a desire to grapple with the fundamental facts, but to argue about motive. Democrats were out to get Brett Kavanaugh from the start, and this only came up at the last minute, so we can't be bothered to deal with it. Democrats were out to impeach President Trump from before he was even sworn into office, and their Russia hoax fizzled. I'm quoting the Republican line in case any listeners think that I'm endorsing this view. And so, therefore, we can't deal with the very serious reality of the Ukraine episode. In both cases, it's this reflexive tribalism that wants to pretend that the motives of critics undermine the seriousness of the allegations that a responsible Congress, and in the case of Justice Kavanaugh, a responsible Senate that has advice and consent responsibility under the Constitution would have been pursuing.
That's the heart of your argument, that impeachment is Kavanaugh 2.0?
Yes, and that we're talking about motive instead of facts, that we just go to our corners in this tribalism. And, you know, there's a little bit of fair both sides do it in this situation. I write in the book that actually I thought before the Christine Blasey Ford allegations arose that Justice Kavanaugh, who I've known for a long time, since he worked for Ken Starr, amazingly, was a pretty credible, well-qualified, run-of-the-mill Republican nominee within the mainstream of conservative judicial thought. That was not the way Democrats looked at it. Almost every Democrat was intending to vote against him from the start. So tribalism goes both ways.
You did write a column recently that in a way was similar to the argument that the Republicans' law professor witness Jonathan Turley made yesterday, that the investigation should go deeper. What's your version of that?
Well, there's a real conundrum that the Democrats are in. And because that we're watching this obstruction of Congress in plain sight and continuing every day, it's like an article of impeachment that occurs anew with every morning and every day that we don't get testimony from really critical people like John Bolton, the former National Security Advisor, like the acting White House Chief of Staff, Mick Mulvaney, like the Secretary of State, Mike Pompeo. And I think that Democrats are in a serious bind. And I am much more sympathetic. I differ from Professor Turley on two grounds. One is I think that there is ample evidence to impeach this president based on what we know now. And second, while I think it is really just shameful that President Trump has been blocking access to this important testimony, I am empathetic with Democrats' understandable eye on the clock, and in particular on the electoral clock, because it is true that the closer we get to an election, the less imperative it is to remove the president from office. And so I think that you can't, it's like the orphan who goes to the judge and asks for mercy. You can't argue that we're not ready to impeach or convict President Trump because he has blocked us from getting information. So I would actually call myself the non-Turley in this debate.
Could it be that in an alternative way of looking at that the Democrats should be less concerned with rushing impeachment to its conclusion, which is almost certain defeat in the Senate before election season, and more concerned with pushing in the courts for John Bolton and Pompeo and everyone to testify and showing the world the full plot wherever and whenever the chips may land?
Well, I'm still, to be completely honest, up in the air and ambivalent about this, which is not usually the position that I find myself in. The reality is that we have not had definitive court rulings on these sorts of issues because in a better and more normal world, the two co-equal branches find accommodations with each other. We've only really pushed this to the Supreme Court level in the Nixon tapes case. One risk that Democrats would have pushing this in the courts is the possibility of losing. But even if they are willing to take that risk, the delay that would occur, I think, even if we think we know what the ultimate outcome here is going to be on impeachment and conviction, I think that the facts involving the president are serious enough that the House is really kind of constitutionally bound, morally bound by the oath to the Constitution to do what it's doing and to pursue these impeachment inquiries. And I also wish that they could simultaneously find a way to pursue impeachment and to aggressively pursue the additional evidence that I'm really convinced they're entitled to.
Ruth Marcus, our guest, Washington Post columnist and deputy editorial page editor, and now the author of the book, Supreme Ambition, Brett Kavanaugh and the Conservative Takeover. And as you've been hearing, she describes the impeachment process as Kavanaugh 2.0 for a variety of reasons. Let me get you on some breaking news this morning, Ruth. First, I'm sure you heard Nancy Pelosi announce that she is now officially asking the Judiciary Committee to draw up articles of impeachment. And just over the wires in the last few minutes here, the Judiciary Committee announces that it will hold a hearing on Monday, next hearing coming Monday, to receive lawyer presentations of evidence in the impeachment inquiry of President Trump from the Intelligence Committee.
And so we now see the kind of stately minuet proceeding that we know was going to happen really from the moment when the impeachment inquiry was formally launched feels like a long time ago, but was only a few weeks ago. I think one of the most interesting questions to watch in the next week is going to involve the scope of those articles of impeachment. It is possible to draw them narrowly, focusing on Ukraine and focusing on this continuing obstruction that I've talked about. It is possible to draw them more broadly. My personal instinct is that Ukraine is different. As outrageous and concerning and impeachable some of the president's previous conduct has been, in particular, the obstruction of justice type activities that the special counsel, Robert Mueller, identified in his report, that Ukraine is different, not in kind, really, but in degree. For me, it moved impeachment from can do to must do. And I think that Democrats would probably be better off as a political matter and also as a legal matter. In other words, making their case to the public and then making their case to the Senate, such as it is willing to consider it. Mm-hmm. On a more take your best evidence, take your strongest evidence, and run with that. Though this completely one of those reasonable minds can differ on this. And just if you don't include the broader questions of the president's conduct in the articles themselves, I don't think that means anybody has to be ignorant of it or try to put them out of your mind. You can kind of take judicial and popular and senatorial notice of all the other things that the president has done.
I want to play a clip. I don't know if you've heard this yet, of about a minute and a half from just after Speaker Pelosi announced that she's asking actual articles of impeachment to be drawn up this morning. This is a minute and a half clip, and it starts with a reporter asking, as she's walking off, do you hate the president? Listen.
Do you hate the president, Madam Speaker? Because
I did not accuse you. I asked a question.
You did.
Representative Collins yesterday suggested that the Democrats are doing this simply because they don't like the guy.
I have nothing to do with it.
I think it's an important point.
I think the president is a coward when it comes to helping our kids who are afraid of gun violence. I think he is cruel when he doesn't deal with helping our dreamers, of which we're very proud. I think he's in denial about the climate crisis. However, that's about the election. This is about the election. Take it up in the election. This is about the Constitution of the United States and the facts that lead to the president's violation of his oath of office. And as a Catholic, I resent your using the word hate in a sentence that addresses me. I don't hate anyone. I was raised in a way that is a heart full of love and always prayed for the president. And I still pray for the president. I pray for the president all the time. So don't mess with me when it comes to words like that.
Speaker Pelosi spontaneously returning to the podium after announcing that she's ordering articles of impeachment to be drawn up after being questioned if she hates the president. Ruth, that exchange is blowing up our Twitter. I don't know if it's blowing up yours as well. But did you hear it previously? Do you know who the reporter is? And what's your reaction?
I am wow, but I'm not surprised that the speaker responded to the word hate, because that is a kind of trigger word for her, because when she talks about her Catholicism and her view of grace and forgiveness and praying for the president, I think that is a significant part of who she is. I think in some ways, and some people may disagree with that she hates finding herself in these impeachment proceedings. She did not want to be here. She resisted the leftward precincts of her caucus and her party for months as they pushed and pushed and pushed to launching these impeachment proceedings. I think she is worried about the political consequences of them. And I think while you can tell, and she has not been shy about saying that she is no fan of the president, I think she is no fan of having to go through this impeachment proceeding, because it's not necessarily good for her politics down the road. And so I think that is a piece of the explanation of why she responded so sharply.
The subtitle of your book is Brett Kavanaugh and the Conservative Takeover. Where does the Kavanaugh part fit into the conservative takeover part?
So conservatives have been for 30 plus years trying without success, foiled by the defeat of Judge Bork, foiled by the choice of Justice Kennedy, who was a conservative but not a totally solid one, foiled by the selection of Justice Souter, who turned out to be a liberal, in assembling a solid and reliable conservative majority. Brett Kavanaugh was their opportunity, finally, after all this time, to have a five-justice conservative majority on the court. And that was his ambition was to get there, and their ambition was to get there as well. And when he ran into trouble with the allegations of Christine Blasey Ford and others, they were going to do whatever it took to get him across the finish line, because this was the end of a 30-year effort on their part. And by the time Kavanaugh's nomination ran into trouble, he was, as one of the chief lawyers on the Republican side told me, too big to fail. They weren't going to allow him to fail. They needed 50 votes. And my book tells really the inside story of what they did in order to get there.
Are the two parties not equivalent, in your opinion, in this respect? Democratic presidents appointed Ruth Bader Ginsburg and Sonia Sotomayor, et cetera. Is it not simply that Democratic presidents appoint liberal justices and fight for them, and Republican presidents appoint conservatives and fight for them, and that's just the power of the presidency and of the electorate?
The two parties aren't equivalent in two different ways. One is that Republican presidents, with the exceptions that they now rue and that have been used as cautionary tales of what not to do in the future, Republican presidents, both on the lower courts and at the Supreme Court, have been much more focused on ideology and making sure that the conservative judicial philosophy was going to be represented on the courts, plural. Democratic presidents have been focused on a bunch of things. They include diversity, racial diversity, gender diversity, and less focused on the ideology. People don't remember, but at the time that Justice Ginsburg was nominated, there was concern from the left that she was too moderate.
Pete Buttigieg has floated an idea in his campaign of increasing the court to 15 justices, as you know. But also, he says that would make it less partisan by having five of the justices appointed by the other 10, not by the president. Do you have an opinion about that idea?
I really am not a fan of all sorts of shenanigans to remake the courts, whether to pack them that way or to pack them in other ways that increase them. The one change that I would make and that I think would be extremely useful would be to institute 18-year terms for justices. That would make this less a matter of winning the lottery, where one president could get four nominations. President Trump likes to say, I think I'm going to get five, and one president could get zero. So that would regularize things more. I think 15 justices is way too many, and having them pick their colleagues is a crazy notion, and it's never going to happen. I would say one last thing about the previous question you asked about whether Republicans or Democrats are better at this. Outside of presidents, I think that the architecture of support for Republican nominees and Democratic nominees is really asymmetric. After Bork was defeated, Republicans basically decided never again, and because they had been outmaneuvered and outgunned by Democrats on that. And so they built up, through the Federalist Society and associated groups, the architecture and the financial structure to make certain that they were going to get their nominees in place and confirmed. And Democrats have not been able to match in any way close that process in the years since Bork.
Ruth Marcus, Washington Post columnist and deputy editorial page editor, and now the author of Supreme Ambition, Brett Kavanaugh and the Conservative Takeover. Ruth, thank you so much.
Thank you so much for having me.